Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Around the world, there are 1.3 billion people who live on less than a dollar a day. And many places around the world, people are having to spend more than ever on housing, gasoline, food, and medicine. Household debt is at an all-time high. And there are many governments who are failing to make important investments in their country's infrastructure and in their educational systems. Here's the question: how did we get to this point? This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with journalist John Jeter about his book, Flat Broke in the Free Market, the subtitle, How Globalization Fleeced Working People. It's published by W.W. Norton. And indeed, he argues that the big problem here is economic globalization. He argues that it's created poverty where it didn't exist before. It has increased the price of basic goods and services, and it has changed the nature of work. That's the subject here this morning in this part of Focus 580. And certainly as we talk, questions and comments from listeners are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people when they call in is just that they try to keep their questions and comments brief so that we can keep moving, get in as many different callers as possible. But of course, questions, comments are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. John Jeter was the Washington Post bureau chief for South America from January 2003 until July of 2004. He also served as the Post bureau chief for Southern Africa between 1999 and 2003. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2000 for a series that he did on the AIDS epidemic in Africa. And he went to work first for the Post in 1993, and he wrote about social policy, about welfare reform and politics, and he also spent some time as the Post's Midwestern bureau chief based in Chicago. Before he joined the Post, he worked for a number of other papers, including the Detroit Free Press, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and the St. Petersburg Times. And in 1991, he was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for a Star Tribune series on race. Well, as we talk here in this hour, again, I want to give the phone numbers. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Jeter, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Just as a way of starting here, because I think globalization is a term that's tossed around a lot, and I think because it means different things to different people and has both supporters and detractors, just to define our terms, when you talk about economic globalization, this is now shorthand for a number of things. What is it that to you that means?
Yeah, that's a great question. To me, I am referring to, in the book, I am referring to sort of this fundamentalist approach to the marketplace, this what economists would call neoclassical, or in fact sort of just a very updated version of very old classical theory in terms of very conservative policies, much like we would see in sort of The Wealth of Nations. Reading The Wealth of Nations, it's sort of an updated version of it. So it's sort of this, the integration of the global economy in a way that is very, very rigidly, ideologically conservative, austere, and targeting things like inflation, emphasizing low inflation more than anything else, really. Uh-huh.
And it also seems that a couple of the key things that people would say are important is that it emphasizes the free movement of capital, that is, of money, and also of labor from one place to another.
Well, yes and no. That's very true. That is sort of how it's described often. But one thing I talk about a little bit in the book is how, you know, this is actually not always true. So, for instance, the sort of insistence of globalization, you know, as framed by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United States Treasury, the insistence that intellectual property be patented, be protected. Mm-hmm. In other words, if I am South African, I want to use a generic brand of trade medicine, I have to, or to use anti-AIDS medicine, I have to pay, a pharmaceutical company X amount of dollars to pay for their research. That's actually restricting trade. That's not actually opening trade up. So you see sort of small things like this in which the way that globalization has played out, it's actually not expediting trade. It's actually a restriction, a barrier to trade.
Mm-hmm. Though I guess that, again, the idea is that somehow there should be as little restriction and regulation as possible.
That is sort of the idea, mm-hmm. as it's described typically, yes.
And you, I think for you, what led you into wanting to spend time concentrating on this issue, it's sort of my understanding that over time you would talk with economists who would speak in favor of globalization, and they would talk about how good it's been mm-hmm. for the world. But the problem was that in the kind of reporting that you were doing, particularly in some of the places that you went and people that you met and got to know a little bit in Southern Africa and in South America, that certainly their lives hadn't improved. And in fact, you seem to argue that globalization made their lives worse. That is, you know, maybe they weren't wealthy before, but somehow the nature of their situation, in fact, the nature of poverty, you say it's actually changed.
That's exactly right. I'm certainly not an economist, and certainly don't have a head for figures. But in my reporting, particularly once I moved to Southern Africa, South Africa, working in Southern Africa mostly in 1999, I wrote a lot about economics, and I would often talk to economists back here in the States, most of whom sort of described a world that was just the opposite of what I was seeing. They described a process of globalization that would create wealth for people, relatively speaking. And I was seeing just the opposite everywhere, and people, ordinary people, you know, not trained economists, but ordinary people were describing their living conditions and how they had worsened over the exact same period of time in which their countries had adopted these very austere, conservative economic principles.
Mm.
And so, yeah, that's exactly right. This book is really trying to reconcile this tremendous contradiction between what globalization is supposed to do and what it's actually done.
Let me ask you one other quick question, and then I have a caller here. I want to promise this person I'm not going to make them wait too much longer.
Okay.
I know that people who are supporters of globalization would say something like this. They'd say, well, it is true that the results here have been uneven. But they would say something like, well, if you look at places, particularly in East Asia, and maybe also some places in Latin America, you can see that things have improved and that per capita income has actually gone up. At the same time, they would say that you are certainly right in your observations that some places, and I guess sub-Saharan Africa probably would be the big case, that you're right that things have gotten worse, that poverty has increased, that per capita income has declined. But what they would say is that this is not so much about globalization as it is about bad governance, and that if the governments of these countries had done things differently and done a better job by their people, then in fact those people would be doing better.
That's exactly right. Corruption is always comes up, and certainly the countries that I write about, almost all of them have issues with corruption, and their populations would be better served if their governments weren't as corrupt. That is certainly true. However, you know, the real contradiction you see is that the countries that have done well have done it by doing precisely the opposite of what globalization, as is prescribed by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, precisely the opposite of what their prescriptions are in terms of economic policy. China, for instance, in terms of its investments in infrastructure and land reform, which is a very key element in industrialization, actually, in terms of their monetary policy, which is the exact opposite of what's happened throughout most of the world. They've done things sort of very differently. And also, I should say, while China is in some ways the sort of the very stark example, the sort of very the standout over the last 30 years, it's also not seen the kinds of social mobility, economic mobility for its population that we saw, say, 100 years ago in the United States and Western Europe in terms of its industrialization process. So the benefits have been slower, have been more concentrated among the elites, the wealthy and the upper middle class. And you know, I talk about Chile in the book, and Chile is sort of a perfect example. People typically describe Chile as being a country where there is very little corruption. I have no idea if that's true. I saw signs of corruption while I was there, and signs that there wasn't very much corruption. But Chile, during the Pinochet dictatorship between 1973 and 1989, basically, its economy failed miserably. And so the question, and now since 1990, they've had the fastest growing economy in Latin America. So the question is, was it somehow corrupt during that period when its economy was undergoing these boom and bust cycles, very much like what we've seen in the United States over the last 20 years? Did they clean up the corruption after that? It doesn't seem that that's the case. And so corruption seems to me sort of a canard, really, that's sort of dragged out to sort of defend globalization. And if you take a close look at it, I've never seen that is actually the case, that corruption is the sort of lever which trips up these countries. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, John Jeter. He was Washington Post bureau chief for Southern Africa and also for South America. He is the author of a recently published book, Flat Broke in the Free Market, How Globalization Fleeced Working People. That's the title and subtitle. It's published by W.W. Norton. We have a caller here, and they've been patient, and we'll get right to them. This is line one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. I had a personal inkling that this is an anecdote, that globalization had gone way too far. About 10 years ago, I was walking through a grocery store in Urbana here, and they had a large display of 17-inch color television sets made in Russia for sale for like $90 or something like that. And I thought to myself, what are these things doing here? You know, first off, how many damn TVs you need to buy a week anyway? I mean, in a grocery store. So, this has gone way, way too far. And I myself have seen. I used to work for as a dispatcher for a trucking company here locally that has since gone out of business. We used to pick up commercial air conditioners made by the Carrier Corporation that used to be made in Tennessee, but now they're made in Mexico. I don't know why, except that the labor rates are cheaper in Mexico, which is, I guess what I'm getting at this globalization seems to me to be, at its basis, the classic conflict between capital and labor. And really, at the heart of it, what globalization is, at the end of the day, is a race to the bottom. Anywhere you can make something cheaper than you can make it here, and justify the transportation costs and so on and so forth, that's where it's going to go. You know, we started seeing this in the early 80s when the so-called right-to-work laws came into effect in certain states in this country, and, you know, like the Saturn plants in Tennessee and the Toyota plants and Mississippi and so on and so forth, where the union workers or the non-union workers there get paid about two-thirds or half of what their union brethren do other places. I'm sort of rambling here a bit, but if you would comment on that, please. Thank you.
All right.
That's a great question, and that's I think you have it exactly right. Globalization really does pit increasingly or deepens the conflict between capital and labor. And an element of globalization that you see everywhere are declining wages, the rise of the service economy, the decline of manufacturing. You see that almost everywhere, except, of course, East Asia, where you see that manufacturing doesn't pay what it used to pay, or at least not what it paid in the Western countries as they were industrializing. And one anecdote of my own really speaks to what you were saying there, is that something I heard in my travels abroad, both in Southern Africa and in South America, and I heard it in different languages, which is you know, so ironic to me that people would sort of say this, variations of this sort of saying, and I first heard it in Mozambique, and it's that this woman once told me, she said that, you know, before their country sort of opened up to the global market, before there was nothing on the shelves, on the grocery store shelves, on the department store shelves, there were very few items on the shelves, but everyone had some money. Everybody had some money in their pocket. Now the shelves are full of stuff. There's plenty of stuff on the shelves, but no one has any money. And I thought that was more profound than anything any economist had ever told me, or most economists had told me, to describe what globalization meant, what it meant to experience globalization as a worker, as a working class person. And it really sort of describes just sort of what is the emphasis of globalization, which is, you know, it's really a dispossession of people's wages, dispossession of people's earned income in terms of, you know, what they buy, what's available for them to buy, and the exploitation of their wages to rising prices for all sorts of things. And even when prices are cheaper, as, you know, things for televisions and technological stuff has decreased, it's at the expense of work. People are being put, you know, the cheaper the products are, the more work we've probably lost to produce it.
Yeah.
And so I think the caller has it exactly right, that this is sort of the classic tension. And everywhere you go where you see sort of globalization has taken hold, you see that there is this very real de-emphasis on labor unions. You see that labor unions have declined almost in inverse proportion to the rise of the strengthening of these global economic policies.
You know, it strikes me that one of the issues here has to do with this major focus of turning your economy outward, in the sense that you're saying, what can we make that we can sell to somebody else? And that it may be in large economies you can deal with a major focus like that. But in a smaller economy, first of all, you have this question of, well, what is it that we can make and sell to somebody else? And if your economy is primarily based on agriculture, that can be very difficult. And then you face the question of, then if things really open up, that your economy, your country starts to become flooded with stuff from outside, which is cheaper than you can make it at home. So what homegrown industries there were, for example, you talk in the book about Africa and how homegrown textile industries, clothing manufacturers, have essentially been put out of business because of cheap imports from clothes coming from outside.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, I think. You know, what you see really is this. No one, including myself, would argue that it's bad to sell more of your products, more of your domestically produced products abroad. That, you know, obviously, if you sell more stuff to more people, you know, you'll be richer. If you, you know, as an individual or as a company or as a country, you'll be better off. The question is, how do you position yourself to do that? And so many countries, particularly in the developing world, it's very difficult for them to do that because, of course, they have the burden of history. And so in Africa in particular, they've had this skewed development that results from colonialism, where they, you know, essentially Zambia, a country I write about, when it was liberated from British colonial rule in, I think, 1963, they had 3 college graduates in the entire country. So the manufacturing process is debilitated by this history, and catching up, sort of, you know, all of a sudden saying, okay, we're all even, let's all sort of produce stuff and see, you know, who can sell what to whom. You know, it doesn't work that way. And, you know, you see in Latin America, where they had basically throughout the continent, they had a program that economists call import substitution, where basically countries made what they needed. So if, you know, you had your domestic textile industry, a car industry, you made what you needed. Now, that has a disadvantage in that it can tend to drive up inflation. But one of the sort of the dirty secrets of globalization is that inflation is a bad thing. It's bad for poor people and for wealthy people. But your economy can survive a certain amount of inflation. In other words, it can continue to grow. People can continue to prosper. You know, if inflation reaches rates of as high as 30%, I believe the literature says. And of course, you know, inflation, if you have no money, is completely irrelevant. It means absolutely nothing. And so, striking this balance between inflation and job growth and manufacturing growth in particular, particularly in value-added industries. One thing I can't remember if I actually say this in the book, write this in the book, but, you know, Africa, which produces all this coffee, have no coffee roasters on the continent. They have to ship all the coffee to be roasted, you know, abroad to the UK and to the United States. That's where the money is for workers. Things like that, and these are the kinds of things they don't have because of the sort of uneven economic commercial development in their country.
You give an example like that, would it start thinking about how in some disturbing ways it actually starts to sound like it's the kind of economy that some of these places had when they were colonies.
I think that's exactly right. And I talk about that too, just sort of the links between colonialism and what most of the world actually calls neoliberalism, which is globalization, really, these neoliberal, neoclassically liberal economic principles. It is really a reversion to this kind of global economy where capital exploits working people. And so what you see is sort of this sort of very curious links, to say the least, between what they charged in a country like Zimbabwe, what the sort of the European colonialists charged, this hut tax, a tax on property for people who basically had been displaced from their homes. To build a hut, you had to pay the provincial government a hut tax. Well, how different is that from a subprime mortgage? It's exploitation, really. It's profiteering. And that's sort of the connection I make between colonialism and globalization, because it serves the same people and it hurts the same people.
Well, is the problem most acute in countries where their economies are essentially based on agriculture?
Yes, probably. Although it's not quite that clear cut, but yes, because what it means is that country has had this sort of skewed industrial development. They have not sort of turned that corner between becoming an agricultural society and an agricultural-based economy to an industrial-based economy. And so, yes, it would be, because agriculture doesn't provide the kind of modern wages and modern development that a country really needs to sort of prosper and grow. Growth is just key, particularly per capita growth. And so agricultural economies are handicapped in that way. One of the things I talk about, are you still there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the things I talk about is just how important land is all over the world, particularly in developing countries, obviously. We had it here in the United States with the Homestead Act of 1879, it was. And what that does, agricultural reform is actually a key component of industrialization. And so many of these countries in Southern Africa in particular, but also in Latin America, never saw this sort of distribution of the land, this sort of very key asset, which helps a country grow from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. And because globalization really frowns upon investment in something like this, because that will cost money. It will cost money to, have a land reform program, an effective one. This is the kind of thing that really really stunts the growth of poor countries, and really stunts their maturation into a fully-fledged, industrialized economy.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Jeter. Let me again introduce him. He worked for the Washington Post as the bureau chief for South America from January 2003 to July 2004. Then before that, he was the bureau chief for Southern Africa for the Post between 1999 and 2003. And then before that, he was the Midwestern bureau chief for the paper based in Chicago. He also has worked for the Detroit Free Press, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the St. Petersburg Times. He was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his work reporting on AIDS in Africa when he was working for the Post. He was a finalist for the prize. And he's the author of the recently published book, Flat Broke in the Free Market, How Globalization Fleeced Working People. And it's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to what I think is a kind of a key idea here that you have written about, and again, not only based on your reporting in Africa and Latin America, but some of your reporting here in the United States. And that has to do particularly in the developing world, about how the nature of poverty is changing. And one wouldn't say that, poverty is something new. There were poor people in the 80s and there were poor people before, but that somehow something about their situation is different now. What would that be?
Well, there is a certain what we see here in the United States in terms of poverty, when we think about particularly, the ghettos on the south side of Chicago, in south central Los Angeles, and southeast Washington, D.C., there's a particular quality to that that poverty. It's based on dislocation, on this sort of almost violent sort of uprooting and disruption of family life and communities. We see high crime. Crime is not something, you know, particularly, you know, domestic crime. Certainly there was political crime in a lot of these countries. But crime, which is really sort of a product not so much of poverty. Poverty is an issue, but more inequality. And so there's a quality to the poverty that we've sort of shipped abroad, much like we used to ship cars abroad or you know, our Hollywood movies. We've shipped sort of our brand of poverty abroad. And so you're seeing things all over the world that really weren't characteristics of that society. So, for instance, in Argentina, although they're in a recovery now, things are getting better, but you saw beginning in 1990 almost sharply this rise in this decline in the marriage rate. Now, some people say, well, that's because they it's a Catholic country and they didn't have divorce until I think roughly 1987 or something like that. It's not that, because the divorce rate has not changed basically since they actually began created a divorce law. It's the marriage rate. People aren't getting married, and you think about who gets married. Men get married when they believe that they can provide for their families. That their futures will be better. That they have work that will take them somewhere better than they are today. And if they don't have that, they don't get married. And also because you've seen the shift from manufacturing to the service economy. Well, that means that there are more jobs for women, which is not all in all a bad thing, except those jobs don't pay very much, and they also it really widens this sort of estrangement between men and women. When women are working, men can no longer sort of fulfill what they feel are their traditional roles in the society and in the family and in the community. And so this is what I mean by sort of the poverty is different now as a result of globalization than it used to be.
Who, if you talk to people, and certainly you have done, you talk to people about this and about their lives, and you ask them, why do you think this has happened, or who do you think is responsible? What do they say?
That's a good question. It depends. It varies wildly. I mean, there is certainly, I think most people, no matter where you are, will sort of identify their sort of the sort of local political and commercial class. So, I have a chapter in the book where I write about Congressman Bobby Rush, who serves the 1st District in Chicago. And, you hear a lot of people in Chicago and South Side particularly talk about Bobby Rush, not so much in terms of globalization, but in terms of how he represents increasingly this business class that is his constituencies, more so than the people. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing you really hear. I mean, in South Africa, of course, you hear people talk about their disillusionment, their disappointment in the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela's liberation political party, their disillusionment because they have, in the last 15 years since they've taken control of the country following apartheid, they've seemed to serve a different master, which is the business community, the global business community at that, at the expense of the working class people, the people who really voted for them and had high expectations of them and their country following apartheid. So, I guess, as much as all politics are local, all economics are local, and that's something you see everywhere where people are really sort of disenchanted with their sort of political class and their business class, which are, I think, in a lot of people's eyes, one and the same.
Yeah. And certainly the post-apartheid government in South Africa has faced a lot of challenges, and there are a lot of people who are very unhappy because they feel that the promise of the change just wasn't fulfilled. But it seems to be a pretty remarkable thing that you could get somebody in South Africa who would say something like, well, apartheid was bad. Yeah, it was bad. But that they then might turn around and say, but we're worse off now than we were then, in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't want to twist this into any kind of apology for
apartheid.
And no one, of course, in South Africa would ever say that apartheid was better. But in a material sense, and some very concrete indicators, people, generally speaking, in South Africa are worse off. They never, during apartheid, had an unemployment rate of 40%. That is the widely acknowledged unemployment rate in South Africa now. It's 40%. They never had anything close to that during apartheid. They never had electricity cutoffs and these sort of, which is a result of deregulation and privatization of the utility companies there, and it's caused a spike in their electricity prices. That's, of course, you know, anyone in Illinois would know, would recognize. I mean, there's been a tremendous spike in utility rates all over the world, and so now they have whole blocks in Soweto, the township in outside Johannesburg, where they go dark because people just can't afford the rate. So these kinds of things, you know, people are experiencing, and it is sort of it's very disappointing for people who have sacrificed so much, who sort of emerged from this very colonial period, only to find that in some ways this sort of model of globalization in some ways deprives them even more of the thing, of the very things they want and need for a better life.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Let's go next to Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. I missed part of the program, so perhaps you touched on this, but what disgusts me about free trade, world trade, is the absolute absence of any workers' rights. Which, of course, is the very same conditions that inspired Karl Marx to invent communism. Can you comment on that?
That's exactly right. It's funny, not in a comical way, but in a very tragic way, actually, that the language has changed because, of course, in globalization, sort of the framers of globalization don't talk about workers' rights; they talk about labor market flexibility. I've always thought that whenever you hear the terms labor market flexibility, if you're a working person, you're about to get screwed. And this is exactly what happens, where basically there's been this de-emphasis on wages, on protections for workers, and it's really very crass. I mean, this is not sort of an accidental thing. It's based on this idea that somehow you're going to create jobs. You create more jobs, the jobs become more secure by paying people less and by being able to hire and fire them easier without paying any kind of penalty, which, of course, is just, for any working-class person, you recognize that as being absurd. And I talked to some women in Brazil who basically Brazil has seen this tremendous drop in their birth rate as a result of these sort of very public campaigns to reduce the birth weight as a way of easing poverty. You know, governments and other organizations there have sort of encouraged women to sort of have tubal ligations so that they sterilize them, basically. And of course, poverty has grown during this period. So there's this sort of these women who recognize that, you know, having fewer children, while of course mathematically, you know, you might be slightly better off, it doesn't create jobs. It doesn't, you know, pay you a decent wage. And so there really is this sort of attack, assault on workers everywhere as a result of globalization.
Well, what is the solution? Should President Obama call an international conference to institute some workers' rights?
I'm sorry, what's that again?
What is the solution? Should President Obama call an international conference to institute workers' rights?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. I certainly would love to see. I'll give you one solution. I don't think there's any one solution, but I'll give you one idea which I think would actually help workers a lot and may help turn the tide that we've seen over the last 25 years. I would love to see something like this Employee Free Choice Act pass in a sort of original state where and the Employee Free Choice Act is something that would basically make it easier for workers to unionize. It would eliminate secret ballot, or at least the workers could choose whether they want the secret ballot, and they could just assign a card to approve a union in their company. And this is something I think that would really sort of see some real changes, real improvements in working conditions, wages throughout the country. I mean, it's no accident that in a country like Sweden, which has, of course, you know, single payer health care, which has 6 weeks paid vacation, I think, for every worker by law, six weeks required by law. And here you have no single payer health care, you have no vacation that's required by law, and we have 12% of the workforce is unionized here. In Sweden, it's 79%. I mean, that's no accident. That is exactly the way it appears.
What is that phrase again you used? for the corrective action? Workers free what?
Oh, it's the Employee Free Choice Act. It's legislation that is pending in Congress now. The last I've read about it is, you know, it is undergoing some tinkering and some compromise. You know, I hope it won't be watered down to the point that it's ineffective. But it is it's a proposal that has really been pushed by unions, but unfortunately opposed with even more force and more money by some of the big corporations, you know, Walmart, Starbucks, Whole Foods, places like this, who really oppose this. Because, of course, you know, unions, as flawed as unions have been in this country, they've played a very clear role in sort of social mobility for workers.
Thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. Once again, our guest is John Jeter. He was a Washington Post bureau chief for Southern Africa from 1999 until 2003, and then he was the bureau chief for the Post for South America from 2003 to 2004. His work twice was finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he is the author of the recent book, Flat Broken, the Free Market, How Globalization Fleeced Working People. It is published by W.W. Norton. On we go to some other callers. Next up will be in someone in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I have several comments. One, it seems to me that you have a tendency to take any and all problems that you find in the world and attribute them to globalization. And it seems to me that you really need to sort out whether that is, in fact, the cause, or whether it's related, or whether it's simply a separate kind of thing. Number two, I think we need to separate problems that are due to transition, that is, as the global economy expands, an industry grows in one country and declines in another country. And so obviously the workers that are put out of work in one country are going to feel the pain until they find another alternative elsewhere, which may take some time, and of course the pain is real. I think one of the things you need to do is look at the statistics of what is happening in an economy rather than simply looking at anecdotal evidence. And when I say statistics, you know, I'd ask you to look at, well, you know, what's the growth rate in South Korea over the last 10 or 20 years? What about 7 or 8% growth in China over the last several years? I don't think that those kind of growth rates in large economies, in many economies around the world, would have happened absent globalization. So I think there's a lot of positives that you're not mentioning. I'll listen to your comments. Thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you for your question. Actually, in the book, I talk about this at length, and I actually mentioned quite a few statistics. In fact, this book is based very much on sort of looking at statistics and trying to reconcile that with sort of the propaganda, if you will, about globalization. So you talk about growth rates. Well, the growth rate worldwide is, and I may have this slightly wrong, but it's about a little bit more than half between – the growth rates worldwide, per capita GDP growth, gross domestic product, and per capita income growth worldwide between 1960 and 1980 is almost double what it was between 1980 and 2000. Latin America per capita growth, per capita income, which is actually the best measure for growth, economic growth, per capita income in Latin America between 1960 and 1980 grew 82%. Between 1990 and 2005, it grew 13%. The statistics are very clear, actually. This is not based on anecdotal evidence. It's based on sort of how the anecdotal evidence fits very, very clearly with the statistical evidence. Marriage rates worldwide have gone down in countries where you've seen almost a perfect, they've gone out in tandem with a manufacturing rate. So at the same time that Argentina was seeing a decline in their marriage rate, their car industry was knocked back in 2003, was producing at 1965 levels. There's a very clear correlation. I mean, this is, you said that I blame globalization for everything. I certainly do not. But the very clear, the very sort of, I think irrefutable fact is that, you know, without work, without, you know, decent work, things fall apart. I mean, it's really the center of social social life in every community is work. And this is what we've seen unravel, and it's had impacts that have rippled throughout the entire world, throughout countries everywhere, almost everywhere. And even, you know, you mentioned, of course, growth rates in Asia. Again, the countries where that have seen sort of this sustainable growth, and I think you really have to look at growth rates over a period of at least 10, 20 years. You can't, you know, we've seen, of course, in the United States, we've seen this boom and bubble economy where we've seen, you know, tremendous growth 1 year or maybe even 5 or 6 years, and we see this sort of this flattening out of the economy, this bust of the bubble, basically. That's growth that's based on speculation. We're not producing anything. Our countries aren't producing anything. And so if you look at sort of a country like Chile, for instance, you know, its experience, again, you know, based in very much on speculation under the Pinochet regime, and they had failures that were almost a harbinger of what was to come here. And since 1990, they've based it on production, actually producing things. It's not a perfect economy. They still have issues there with inequality, but they have invested more money in education, in health, in the transfer of technology. They have re-entered the market as opposed to withdrawing from it, and they've seen very different results. So I would disagree with the caller in that that there's sort of this sort of case against globalization is based just on anecdotal evidence. The statistical evidence is actually very, very strong.
All right, let's go to Urbana for the next caller, line number 3. Hello.
Hello. One of the things that dismays me about professional academic economists is how much they are driven. They claim to be scientists, but how much they're driven by faith commitments rather than objective evidence. And I was alerted to this, I don't know, 25 years ago when Milton Friedman was in his prime, and he did a film series on PBS on the economy of Asia. And he touted Japan as an exemplar of free trade, and the great success that their economy was having at that time was all based on free trade. And I've only had one undergraduate economics course in my life, but I happened to be paying attention to Japan because my wife was raised there. And as a layperson, it was obvious that he didn't know anything at all about the Japanese economy. They have a very heavy-handed industrial policy, export-driven economy, minimized domestic consumption, and that's been replicated over and over by the other so-called Asian tigers. And Friedman drew exactly the opposite conclusion from it. He argued that these were demonstrating the virtues of free trade, and it's not at all free trade.
Right.
It's planned trade, export, discourage local consumption, and the Chinese have been doing it very, very successfully now for the last 15 years. It happens over and over again, and yet we get suckered into this free trade rhetoric, and we open our borders to imports. We don't do anything to encourage exports. And it just strikes me that we've been big suckers for the last 30 years.
Now, Mr. Jeter, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, I talk about a meeting I had with Milton Friedman shortly before his death, of course, the sort of the father of neoliberal economics, of globalization in some ways, the intellectual father of it, and how he says, I asked him at one point sort of to assess the global economy over the last 25 years. And this was in 2006 after I traveled abroad and had began sort of thinking about these issues. And he says, you know, the global economy over the last 25 years has been excellent. And this really made me realize exactly what the caller is talking about, that there is a sort of there's a very clear class conflict. And what he was talking about, I think, what he was speaking of was he was talking about it had been excellent for people of his class, for the investors, for the bondholders, for stockholders, for the speculators, it had indeed been excellent. But at the expense of ordinary people, ordinary working class people, it had been just the opposite. And those weren't unrelated. Those were, in fact, there was a cause and effect there. It was a redistribution of wealth. And so, it's exactly right that there is this sort of idealized, almost romanticized vision of free trade, some of it dishonest, some of it just sort of, I think, people really are willfully blind to it, people who are sort of big supporters of globalization. But it's not, in the end, it's not sort of, I don't make an argument for you know, certainly not communism or even sort of socialism, but really the economies that have worked the best, including our own here in the United States, particularly after World War II, have been very mixed economies, economies that aren't so sort of ideologically driven. I mean, I was certainly not, you know, if anyone were asking me, God forbid, how to sort of, you know, structure their economy, I wouldn't argue that you, you know, outlaw private property. I don't think that's anything that would be helpful, or that you have some sort of centralized command economy. But what you would do, I think, is you would sort of look at what your strengths are and how do you maximize that, all with the goal of production, producing things, making things. And the higher the value that you make things, the more you make things with higher value, the better off people will be. That's exactly what Chile has done. And again, it's not perfect. I mean, you know, there are still issues there, but looking at producing something and sort of shoring up your home base first before you look towards sort of outsiders to help you. I mean, this is almost sort of, in some ways, almost like a self-help manual, you know, for people. I mean, you have to sort of like take care of yourself first before you, you know, look to outsiders to help you. This is really kind of the lesson, I think, of globalization over the last 30 years, is that, you know, you have to sort of have your own homegrown manufacturing industry and then look to export those goods in a way, on terms that are favorable to your population. And so it's, you know, it's not, there's no ideological sort of bent to my book, or I think even to many of the economists who support or who are against globalization. They still merely see that there's a value in having sort of an economy that is more, that has an industrial strategy, and that is maybe not, that is flexible, is I guess the point.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I have some other callers. I want to try to get at least one, if not both of them. We'll go next to Chicago and line 4.
Milton Friedman also said the objective of business is to maximize profits for the shareholders and to not be concerned about social responsibility. And therefore, we see the results of that, to the point where profit making is so huge in the financial area without any real labor. All that is, the economy has been based, I think you said, 30 to 40% of the profits of their gross national is based upon financial transaction profits.
Right.
And we have the other matter of when we talk about automation and computerization and assembly lines and robots displacing humans in the working productive cycle, what is to become of the human factor in the equation, to the point where they can't even begin to be employed as we traditionally understand, other than in agriculture and so forth, service jobs. So the question of restructuring the whole concept of the four-letter work has to be reconsidered, especially with now with ecological environment and impacts and shifting and so on. So we have a huge restructuring at our doorstep that we have to consider taking into account. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I definitely see the caller's point. I mean, there's a restructuring of the economy, and there is sort of this tendency towards cheaper labor through automation. But if you have a prepared workforce, an educated workforce, if you've invested, if a country invests in their workforce, in their preparation, training, in their own sort of, basically in your human capital, if you invest in that, automation really isn't a threat. I mean, in other words, you know, as you automize some parts of the workforce, if you have workers who are sort of capable of capitalizing on that as opposed to sort of being victimized by it, it's not a threat. It's not a problem. But, again, that calls for, you know, looking at your economy as something that produces something and investing in workers, you know, not as a cost, but not as a deficit to your economy, but as an asset.
Hmm. Real quick, we'll try to get one more caller here. Champagne, line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm calling from Champaign. I was listening at the end. So the gentleman is very right, very correct about everything. There are a few very smart callers, too, that's very nice. Of course, people like those are immediately labeled conspirator, theorists, and stuff. Yes, this is what happened. This is the corporate socialism, making majority working for few on the top. And, of course, to be able to do so, extension of English Empire, now American Empire, we have to create World Bank, International Monetary Fund, United Nations, and of course we go and bomb countries and people to protect the finances, banks, and manufacturers and corporations. And for many, many years, since Woodrow Wilson, Federal Reserve, and Roosevelt, the big financiers and the big corporations find a way to incorporate this, how to make majority, the big populations, work for 1%, one big tiny minority. Mm. They implement their laws with help of corrupt politicians who protect them, and they are able to enslave everybody else. And as long as we have this flag-waving rhetorics, and people do not know the truth, and they are ignorant, and they cannot be free, and that's the result. And for many, many years, we thought that in America we're going to be shielded about all of this, losing jobs for cheap labor, and it's okay to go in Vietnam, Korea, and South America, and in Africa, and enslave those people, because of course they are capable of taking care of themselves, but that's not the point. The point is DuPont, Morgan, Rothschild, Rockefeller to make more and more and more, and Walmart, et cetera, et cetera. So great, great program, and I hope they're more like you.
All right. Yeah. Well, I want to thank the caller. Any last quick thoughts you'd like to offer folks, Mr. Jeter?
Well, yeah, I just wanted, based on what the caller just said, too, one last point just to sort of illustrate sort of where we are here now in terms of globalization and this sort of favoring of the financial sector as opposed to the manufacturing or productive sector is, you know, look at sort of the way we've handled the bank bailout and the auto, the Detroit bailout, the bailout of the big three, and sort of, you know, this idea that we're going to sort of revive our economy by basically through borrowing, through debt, by extending loans, by pumping up the banks so they can make more loans. It's unsustainable. How, you know, who can borrow now? Very few people can actually borrow. They're already overextended. It's not sustainable. I think that's sort of the key point of the book.
We got to leave it at that. The book is Flat Broken, the Free Market, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest John Jeter. Thanks very much, Mr. Jeter.
Thank you.